Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum, Collect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Kishore Hari, the director of the first ever Bay Area Science Festival. But why we're all here tonight is to lift the veil on the subconscious, that hidden universe that exists behind this face with David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist at Baylor School of Medicine and author of Incognito. I'm going to get right to it, but before we dive into all the details, can you distinguish the whole term brain and mind and what the difference is between the two?
So the brain is the hardware. It's the 3 pounds of wet, gushy stuff in the skull. And the mind is sort of the software program that runs on top of that. So the mind is all the stuff, you know, and when we think about the conscious mind, of course, we mean the part that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning. That's the conscious part. But of interest to me, and I suppose this is what we'll talk about, is the fact that that conscious bit is the smallest bit of the operations of the brain.
So give us an idea of scale here, because I keep hearing that the brain is the most complex machine ever created. And there's more neurons than there are stars in the sky.
Oh, it's actually even better than that. It turns out, right, so just to get a sense of the scale, so there are about 100 billion neurons just making up the outside, the cortex of the brain. And each one of those neurons is as complicated as a city. It has the entire human genome in it. It has millions of proteins trafficking around. Mm-hmm. Each one of these neurons is connected to about 10,000 others. And so if you took just a little tiny chunk of brain tissue, there are as many connections in there as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So that's the kind of complexity is. And we haven't discovered anything else like that. It's a very alien kind of computational fabric that we're looking at. It would be like if a spaceship crashed here and we found this weird gushy stuff inside that was sort of, you know, self-repairing and alive and could do incredible sorts of computations. That's what we find in here. And the really weird part, and the reason I wrote this latest book, is because that is us somehow. I mean, this completely foreign object to us that's unlike anything we know how to build is us. It's our hopes, our dreams, our aspirations, all of these things. And the reason we know that is because if the brain gets damaged, if brain tissue gets damaged, even a little bit, that can change you entirely. It changes your decision making, your capacity to simulate possible futures, your risk aversion, your ability to see colors, things like that. So that's how we know that somehow this weird foreign substance is intricately linked to who you are.
So I'm sort of blustering at the notion that the conscious part of our brain is such a small, minute part of our life, because I've pretty much spent 30 years working on that part of my brain. So, with limited success, I might add. But
yeah, I mean, that's what we think, is that we're working on that. But I mean, think about when you have an idea and you say, oh, I just thought of something. It wasn't actually you that thought of it, right? Your brain has been working on that behind the scenes, under the hood, for days or weeks. It's been consolidating information, simulating possible futures, evaluating them. Finally, it serves it up to you and you say, oh, I'm a genius. I just thought of something. But it wasn't actually you, right? It may be that the conscious mind is always the one sort of coming last on the ladder.
So it's really our subconscious is sort of running all the time, and the conscious mind sort of just comes around to what the subconscious has been working on all these years?
It seems to be that way, yes. Your brain is screaming along with activity all the time. You know, something of interest to me is people always, there's this very common urban myth about we only use 5% of our brains. And what got me interested, so it's not true, of course, but what got me interested in is why is it so sticky? Why does everyone believe that? And I think it's because it gives us all hope that maybe we could be a lot smarter than we are. But in any case, it's sort of exactly the wrong story. The real story is that your brain is doing work all the time and you're not even aware of it. Even when you're just sitting around being lazy, you're consolidating information, you're taking out the neural trash, you're coming up with new ideas. and it gets baked and served up when it's ready.
All right. So let's break this down a little bit. So my conscious mind right now is thinking, what's my next question for David going to be? That's a really nice jacket that he has on. How did I spill something on myself before I arrived? And while all of that is happening, what's sort of riding underneath that? Can you give us a couple examples of some things in the background?
Yeah. I mean, it turns out that most of what's running in the background is running very useful programs evolutionarily. So let me just give an example. Because I remember when I first learned about the study, I was very struck by it. Men were asked to rate the attractiveness of women in photographs. So they were looking at these 8x10 photos, and they were rating from 1 to 10 how attractive they found that woman's face. Okay, what the men didn't know is there were actually two sets of photos with the same women in it. The only difference was, over here, the women's eyes had been dilated with some eye drops. So it turns out the men were uniformly more attracted to the women with the dilated eyes. But none of them said, oh, I noticed that her eyes were a millimeter larger here in the pupil diameter, right? None of them noticed that consciously. And none of them presumably knew that dilated eyes was a sign of sexual readiness in women. But their brains knew it. And they were uniformly driven over here. And that's the way love always goes, right? You just find yourself more attracted to certain people. You don't know why, but what's happening is there's all sorts of computations where your brain is picking up on information. There's a real gap between what your brain knows and picks up on and what your mind has access to.
So this dovetails with that whole notion of 70% of communication is nonverbal. Does that sort of fit into this whole point that you're making here around attractiveness?
Yes, boy, that is really true. And I have a section in the book about beauty and attractiveness, and it turns out, you know, most of these things are signals that are broadcasting fertility, most of the things that we find attractive, let's say sexually attractive in other people. So just for example, you know, little children, boys and girls, look about the same. They have the same body shape. But it's when they become fertile, when they go through puberty, that their body types change. And that's those are the signals that we find attractive, a particular hip-waist ratio in women. With men, it's the, you know, the jaw and the broad shoulders and chest and the stubble and all that stuff. Those are the, you know, these are the things that broadcast to our unconscious brains, fertile, you know, attractive. And these things plug in like lock and key, and we don't always know why, but there it is. You know, these serve useful purposes.
So you can actually, in neuroscience, quantify a legitimate effect that somebody that's in a sort of a fertile state is going to be quantifiably more attractive to the opposite sex.
Yes, although this isn't even a neuroscience thing. These are sociologists and psychologists who discovered that. Somebody looked through the decades of Playboy magazine, for example, and found that even while the total weight of the model models have changed over the years, the hip to waist ratio has stayed pegged at exactly 0.7 the whole time through the decades. So purveyors of pornography are ahead of neuroscientists this way.
That must have been a really tough study to recruit for, too.
I'll tell you, some of my colleagues in New Mexico pulled off a study. I don't know how we got on this topic. Anyway, we'll get off this soon. But they pulled off a study where they went and did, you know, real science on dancers in strip clubs and looked at their fertility levels through the month when they were going through the menstrual cycles and looked at the tips that they received. And the control group was the strippers who were on the pill. And what they found was that when the women were most fertile, that's when they were getting the most tips. There appeared to be signals broadcast, and, you know, there's a lot of debate about what those signals are exactly. There appears to be a difference in skin tone, in facial symmetry, probably in the way they act, too, and their body language and so on. But it turns out that somehow, unbeknownst to both the strippers and the Casanovas and the Gentlemen's Club, there are signals being exchanged there, and you can quantify that with the monetary exchange that results from that.
So they got more tips?
Yes.
They literally made more money when they were on...
Oh, yeah. It tracks exactly with the fertility cycle. And the women who were on the pill got the same amount of tips on average.
Oh, so you could just work 2 days a month, three, four days a month.
That's and exactly really right. Well. Yeah. This is what fiscally responsible strippers will do, yeah.
Yeah. That takes the term applied neuroscience in a whole new direction. So I can sort of see how this could be true, the notion of... Our brain is just bombarded with so much information, and when it comes to attraction, there's so much information that just gets by our conscious mind and just sort of seeps in, and there's a sort of a stickiness to the person. I mean, that's how I ended up married. But when it comes to something like perception, like vision, does that still hold true? Like, do we still see things that slip by and get into our subconscious? Are really drivers around this?
Yeah, this is interesting because the whole issue of vision and seeing the world is actually a very deep issue, because it turns out that our conscious minds accept the reality out there as being our reality, but in fact, vision is essentially a construction of the brain. It's a grand illusion. I mean, for example, you probably know that colors don't actually exist in the outside world. You just have electromagnetic radiation of different wavelengths, but our brains construct that. Our brains are locked in darkness and silence inside of the skull. All they ever see are electrical and chemical signals, and yet they construct all of this. And it turns out that what we see in the world is just what's useful for us. We don't actually see everything that's out there. I mean, for example, we're trapped on this very small strip between the infinitely huge and the infinitely small, where things have very different physics and behave completely differently. We've evolved on these spatio-temporal scales to deal with, you know, apples and rabbits and mates and so on, and that's about all we see. But even within that, we're only seeing a little sliver. So take electromagnetic radiation. If you take the whole spectrum, the part we call visible light is about 1/10 billionth of what's out there. And things like radio signals and CNN and cell phone signals, these are passing right through our bodies. It's completely invisible to us, because we don't have biological receptors for it. And so we take that to be our reality. We say, oh, yeah, this is the world out there. Presumably, every animal has their own little strip of reality. If you're a tick, it's butyric acid and warmth. If you're the ghost fish, it's electrical fields and so on. And they take that to be the world out there. But in fact, we're just seeing a very little bit of it. All that we get in our conscious minds is the summary that we need to get. We don't need to know any of the details of the processing underneath.
So how fine of a difference is there even within our species? So from me to you, am I seeing something, a different world, that different reality that you don't see?
Thanks for that question. Yeah, it turns out one of the things that my lab studies is called synesthesia. Mm-hmm. And this is a condition where people will have essentially a mixture of the senses. So they might hear music and it causes them to physically see colors, or shapes, or movements, or textures, and they're not being artistic or metaphorical, they're actually physically having a visual experience. Or they might hear something and it puts a taste in their mouth, physically. Or they taste something and it puts a feeling on their fingertips, like that.
So like blue tastes salty?
Yes, something like that. Exactly. There are many different forms of synesthesia. Actually, 152 different forms have been tracked now in the literature. One of the most common forms, and surely people in the audience here, some fraction have it, is where you'll see things like letters or numbers, and that will trigger a color experience. For a synesthete with this type, 3 is red and J is purple and so on. And it's not that they're on drugs or something, it's that they actually are having that physical experience, because the parts of their brain involved in letters and numbers are cross-talking with the parts of their brains involved in colors. And so they have that experience.
And it doesn't degrade over time or create any other impact on them except seeing a color with a number.
That's right. In fact, it's probably only advantageous. It doesn't degrade, and it's not disadvantageous. So it's not classified as a disease. Mm-hmm. It's just a neurological phenomenon that we see. It's much more common than previously thought. It's probably 4% of the population has some form of synesthesia.
4%?
Yeah, and most people, of course, will live their whole lives and die without ever knowing that they're a synesthete, because we all assume that everyone sees the world exactly the way that we do. I mean, there's this old conundrum that how do I know what I call orange and you call orange is the same, right? And the answer is it may not be. Our internal experiences may not be the same. As long as we can, our mothers teach us to call that orange, and then we can transact and negotiate in the outside world.
So when we look at, when we go outside and look at the sky and I say, the sky is blue, and you're like, yeah, the sky is blue, that's actually not our brains actually agreeing that the sky is blue. It's our sort of cultural encoding.
It's the label that we both have agreed to put on it, even though our internal experience might be quite different. So this used to be in the realm of philosophical speculation. How do we know if what you call blue is what I experience as blue? How do I know if what I'm seeing is the world is upside down from what you're seeing it? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter as long as we can negotiate. But with synesthesia, we've been able to elevate that to a real scientific problem that we can study. Mm-hmm. So in my lab, we just published a paper with 20,000 synesthetes in it. and we're doing neuroimaging, we're pulling the genes for synesthesia because it turns out it's heritable. But what's interesting about it is that a small genetic change can change the reality that we experience.
First of all, where do you find 20,000 synesthetes? Is there like a special town somewhere? We all see blue and orange? There's twos?
Yeah, no. What I did is I built an online synesthesia battery, which has become the gold standard for testing synesthetes. And so synesthetes from all over the world come to us.
Anyone listening can just go take this test?
Yes. It's a free open test. It's synesthete.org is the website. And this is where people can go to test themselves. And that's how we collect so many thousands. We have it in 8 different languages with interesting different alphabets, Chinese and Hebrew and Greek and so on.
Is there any indication why this, I'm going to use the term mutation. I don't know if that's correct or not. Has sort of evolved.
So the term we use is polymorphism. It's just something where a gene can exist in different states, neither of which are harmful. Well, one of my grad students always insists that synesthetes are going to take over the world because it does seem to be advantageous. It gives us slightly better memory. Mm-hmm. So all of the people that we find with really extraordinary memories, mm-hmm. for example, this guy who can memorize pi, 3.1415, out to 20,000 digits, he's got a very rich synesthesia. So for him, every digit has a color, it has a size, it has a texture, it has a gender, and it has a personality. So 3 might be like an aggressive male in red and flannelly, and 4 is a shy female who's sort of metallic and so on. And what that means is when he's memorizing these 20,000 digits, there's a whole story landscape going on there. That's why he can do it. It would be impossible for a non-synesthete.
It just makes me think that I think this is the way to win a spelling bee.
Yeah.
It's like...
Well, that's exactly right. One of the synesthetes in my lab was a spelling bee state champion.
Yeah. Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, for this reason.
But backtracking to the 96% of us that aren't synesthetes, I find this whole notion of perception that you present as sort of calling into question, like, what is reality on some level. Mm. And I wonder if you see it that way, too, that this whole notion of reality that we built is not exactly true.
Yeah, it's definitely not true. I mean, what we know for certain is there are many illusions. We can demonstrate those in the lab very easily. Illusions of vision. One of the things we do in my lab is illusions of time perception. Mm-hmm. We can make you in the laboratory think something lasted longer or shorter than it actually did, or that came before something else.
Come on, I believe in math and taxes. A second is a second. It's like, isn't that incontrovertible? Because that's not part of our experience. And we can experience time, but isn't time just sort of some quantifiable piece of evidence that
one
just
would
exists
think.
There?
One would intuit that to be true. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of surprising when you find out that instead of passively tracking the river of time, your brain is actually actively constructing it. So just as an example, if I show you a picture of a shoe, and I show you the picture of the shoe again, and then shoe again, and then shoe again, and then a flower, you'll think the flower lasted a lot longer on the screen because it's an oddball. And because it was something your brain wasn't expecting, even if it's physically the same duration as these shoes that I was flashing, it seems to stick on the screen for a lot longer. It's a very perspicuous effect. So we use very simple things like that to quantify how you can have these big duration distortions.
This is sort of, I guess, in the relatable way, would this be those moments where just time just seems to stop for all of us? Those moments when, like, life flashes before our eyes, shooting over our handlebars, if you will?
Well, so I've studied that separately, mm-hmm. right. So one of the things that's always intrigued me is what happens when people feel like time runs really slowly. When I was a child, I fell off of a house under construction, and
it seemed to turn out okay.
It came. Well, we don't have a control experiment, so I don't know how it would have been. But I fell from the roof, and I busted my face up on the ground below. But the thing is, the fall seemed to take a very long time. I was thinking about whether I had time to grab at the tar paper, and then I was looking at the ground, and as I was falling, I was thinking about Alice in Wonderland and how this must have been what it was like for her to fall down the rabbit hole. I was just a kid at the time.
How many stories was this house that you like had time to... Right. But really, that's what
Well, that's exactly the point. Exactly. It seemed to take a long time. I was 8 years old at the time. When I got to high school and learned physics, I thought, oh, this is interesting. So I calculated how long the fall took, and it took 0.8 seconds. And I thought, how could that be that I had all those clear, calm thoughts in 0.8 seconds? So then I grew up and I became a neuroscientist, and I started studying this. So what I did is I took my laboratory to the amusement park in Houston, and we went on all the scariest rides we could find, and we brought all our time equipment to see if we could actually replicate this duration distortion that people have. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't scary enough, it turns out. So my students and I looked around, and we finally found something called SCAD diving, which is where you're dropped from a 150-foot tall tower in free fall backwards, and you're caught in a net below. You're going about 50 miles an hour when you hit the net. And it's really, really terrifying. And but totally safe. So my biggest scientific accomplishment was getting this approved by the ethics board at my university. But I did, and we dropped 23 subjects. I dropped myself 3 times, of course, to make sure it was okay. But what happens is people do have the duration distortion during that. When you ask them to retrospectively estimate how long the event took, it seems to take a lot longer when you're the one doing the falling. It seems to take a very long time. What was surprising is we invented and strapped a device to people's wrist to measure their time perception during the fall. It was a very short experiment. But it turns out that people can't actually see in slow motion during the event. So they're not like Neo in the Matrix actually seeing in bullet time, but instead it's somehow a trick of memory and also of this complete focus and concentration on what's going on. What happens is when you read all that back out, you have so many details, and that's why it seems to last such a long time.
When you say it lasts longer, how much longer are we talking about?
Well, what we were able to measure was a 36% expansion, but I think it was probably longer than that. What happened with a lot of people is, you know, we asked them to replicate it on a stopwatch, and they would finally stop it and say, well, actually, I feel it was longer, but I'm sort of embarrassed to let it keep going, and so they would stop. Mm-hmm. But it's at least 36%, yeah.
So people felt like they were falling for a second and a half almost on a...
It's actually a three-second fall. So they felt like they were falling, you know, 4 or 5 seconds, yeah.
And so what's the explanation behind it, behind the... What's going on in those memory circuits that... Why would it extend? Well, because you wouldn't think that would have any purpose.
Oh, memory is all about writing things down when things are hitting the fan. That's when you want to write it down. That's what memory's for, really, is it's not about being a video camera to accurately... It's about upgrading prediction. Memory only exists so that you'll do things better in the future. So when you're, you know, counting the number of cracks in the sidewalk or something, it just doesn't matter. But when things are life or death, that's mm-hmm. when everything gets written down. And it's actually a secondary memory system that kicks into gear there, a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is an emergency control center, and it writes everything down on what is essentially a secondary memory track. And these are the memories of post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, these are the memories that really stick well. So that's why you have so much more in these.
And that's why the terror was a necessary component to this?
Exactly. Yeah, you need to be terrified.
And this is why you have no more grad students?
Strangely, it's really blossomed the number of grad students who want to come to my lab. Many of whom say they want to volunteer for the experiment, but not all of whom actually follow through with that. It's a little scary. But I'll tell you what I'm interested in next on this topic, which is, so at this point I've collected about 1,000 narratives of people who have been in these situations of, you know, like their motorcycle goes off a cliff or they're sliding on the ice towards the brick wall at 60 miles an hour, that sort of thing. And, you know, I've been able to find these threads that are common across thousands of independent narratives, or hundreds of independent narratives. And one of the things that really is of interest to me is, okay, so first of all, there's this time slowing, but there's also this complete calmness, like I had, and this bizarreness of thought. So just as an example, one guy was in a motorcycle accident, and he was bouncing at 40 miles an hour across the asphalt after he was thrown from his bike, and his helmet was hitting the asphalt. And as that was happening, he was thinking about what a nice little rhythm that made, and he was composing a little ditty to the rhythm of his head, and he was totally calm. Yeah, things like that. But the thing that's really interesting to me lately is this notion of panoramic memory. So a lot of times people right in this moment where they realize they're out of options, they're sliding towards the cliff, they're definitely going off, they have all their memories sort of present at the same time. And it's not like life flashing before your eyes cinematographically. It's instead like everything is there as a panorama. And these aren't necessarily extraordinary memories. They're just banal memories about some moment in the second grade or whatever. And so many people have independently described this that I know there's something neurologically there. And the reason it's interesting is because, you know, in the 1950s, people started dunking electrodes into the certain parts of the brain, the temporal lobe. And if you just zap something, a memory can come out. So there's something about the state of the brain in that situation that puts the brain into a very a unique sort of state where all the memories bubble up to the surface. And the reason that's so interesting is because we don't actually know in neuroscience yet what the difference is between when something is in a conscious and unconscious state. Mm-hmm. So if I ask you to think of your first kiss...
Okay.
So where was it just a moment ago? Just before I asked you, that information was in your brain, but now it's part of your conscious content. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what just happened? What's the difference between those two states? Mm-hmm. We don't know the answer to that, and this seems to me like a really interesting inroad to get at that. So that's what I'm studying next.
So I noticed when you asked me that, immediately my eyes shifted up into the left. Is there a reason behind, like, why when you asked me about my first kiss, did my eyes move? That makes no sense to me.
Makes no sense to me either. I don't know. I don't know why it happened. I noticed you did that also. It might be a social thing. I don't know. You know, social right. broadcasting, they'll say, oh, give me a moment, I'm thinking. I don't know.
Interesting. But so I always wonder, using this information on time perception, what's sort of a useful outcome? Could you actually instigate these kinds of feelings and states of being, you think, by studying them deeper? Could we actually create a situation where we were constantly in that panoramic viewpoint?
Oh, that's interesting. In theory, yes. I mean, a lot of things get accidentally discovered in terms of human capacities. And so, you know, with different drug states or different religious practices or experiences, people have found things accidentally. So it wouldn't be something simple. Maybe it could be something technological about stimulating the brain in the right way. I'm not positive it would be useful. But what I see it as is a really good inroad to understand. It's a really good way to get in there under this question of what the heck is going on. What is a conscious state? What is it? What are the brain patterns that are necessary and sufficient to have, you know, the experience of what philosophers call qualia, you know, the taste of feta cheese? I mean, if we feed you feta cheese and look in your brain, we'll see that neurons are popping off everywhere and there's certain patterns of activity. But why does that equal the taste of feta instead of the feeling of pain or just something going on in homeostasis with your temperature or something? I mean, all of these things are just patterns of activity. So what makes them different? What gives them content?
Let's pull at this thread a little bit. You mentioned off the top that consciousness is a very small part. It's the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could quantify that a little bit. When we're talking about the tip of the iceberg, what percent of our activity is really conscious thought?
Great question. It's impossible to quantify currently. But if you just think about the massive operations going on under the hood, take something like, you know, I was just lifting this water glass to my mouth. That is underpinned by a lightning storm of electrical activity in the brain. It's a very complicated motor act, and I turn my elbow and my wrist and everything just right, and I reach the target. You're not aware consciously of any of that activity. All you're ever aware of is did I get the water to my lips or did I spill it on my shirt? That's all you care about. Because what you want, and, you know, I use this analogy in the book, that all the conscious mind really wants to give is a summary, right? So it's just like a newspaper, like USA Today. You don't care about all the massive happenings in the nation, the factories and the cops chasing criminals and the secretaries and the bosses. You don't care about it. All you want to know is, what's happening?
You want the
right
bar
now.
Graph when you read USA Today.
That's right. That's right. And so that's what you get with the conscious mind, is just a summary of what's going on, because it's enormous. I mean, just consider you've got 100 million neurons controlling your gut, the peristalsis moving the food around your gut. You're not aware of any of that, nor would you want to be, in part because when here's another analogy. The conscious mind is sort of like the CEO of a company. When a company reaches sufficient complexity, it needs a CEO to help with sort of the long-term vision. But you don't want the CEO going into the mailroom or the cafeteria and mucking with things, because it's at a level of operations that he or she just doesn't understand, and it's going to mess things up. And, of course, we see this when you try to consciously do things that you're better off letting the unconscious brain do. For example, if you play piano, you know, during a rehearsal, if you start thinking about where your fingers are going, you're dead, right? Forget about it. Because your brain knows how to operate your fingers at an extremely fast rate, but if you're consciously trying to interfere with it, you're going to muck up the operation.
Is this sort of the idea around how some sports players choke? They start thinking about shooting a free throw, something they've done a million times before, and all of a sudden they're like hitting the backboard and tossing it over the net.
Yeah, and this is why the audience taunts them and claps and yells to try to get them to be more consciously aware of their surroundings instead of in the zone where they're just not thinking. You know, my high school baseball coach used to always, yell at us when we were going on the field. He goes, think out there. And I would say, actually, you know, you want us to not think out there. But anyway, I had to write a book to prove him wrong on that. But the I put a sort of neuroscience insider joke in the book about if you're ever playing a game of tennis and you're losing and you really want to win, there's always a way you can do it, which is you compliment your opponent's serve and you say, wow, you serve the ball so well. How exactly do you do that? And as soon as they start to explain it, they're dead. They can't do it anymore.
So it's
pretty nefarious.
That's your next book, How to Cheat at Sports.
That's it. I just gave away the whole. It's more like a haiku than a book now. Yeah.
But what about the whole notion of this becoming an expert?
Like, oh yeah.
10,000 hours of time practicing on something, you become an expert, and then you don't think about it anymore.
You know, this is the process of automation. So it seems like what the conscious mind's really good at doing is setting some sort of long-term goal of saying, okay, look, I want to be better at tennis, let's say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your coach tells you, look, step into the ball, grip the rack a little bit lower. And so, step into the grip of the racket. You do this. You practice over and over and over. What you're doing is you're actually burning that into the circuitry of your brain. You're reconfiguring your brain, and you automatize it. This gives you speed and efficiency. But it comes at the cost of you no longer have conscious access to it. So it's just like riding a bicycle. When you learn how to ride a bicycle, you're doing a lot of thinking about it. Once you learn how to do it and you automatize it, you no longer can tell how you're doing it. And by the way, when you said the thing before about you're thinking about what to say next, the language is so automatized, all you have to do is open your mouth and words come spilling out faster than you could possibly control the articulation mechanisms going on in your mouth and so on.
Now you're just talking about my life.
Yeah.
That pretty much describes a huge chunk of my history.
Yeah, fair enough. But that's an example of something that's so automatized, we don't have conscious access to how we do that. But of course, if you watch babies, you know, it takes a long time to learn that.
Following this, I'm a relatively new parent, and looking at my son, reading your book, I was thinking, are they coming out as blank slates? Or is this subconscious, conscious sort of battle already ongoing in their brain as we emerge?
Well, I tell you, the blank slate question is really good because it's a very important thing, which is that who we are, how our brain development goes, is a very complicated interaction of genes and environment. So you come to the table with genes. They give you certain sorts of predispositions, but they're not predestination. Everything matters. Your son's in utero environment. What your wife was eating and hopefully not drinking or smoking, things like that. But all of the kids' environment, the things, the toxins in the air, the lead paint on the wall, everything matters for brain development. The really interesting part to me about this whole issue is, you know, we don't choose our genes and you don't choose your childhood environment either. And so what happens is brains end up being very different from one another because of this gene-environment interaction. And you can't take credit for your, you know, good decisions and your successes and so on. And there's a sense in which people can't take blame if they're not very good decision makers or things like that. I'm not saying this in a sense that lets anybody off the hook. I just find it interesting. It's almost analogous to, you know, taking credit for having color vision and taking blame if you're colorblind. You know, it's the same stuff. It's all the biology in the end. And I find this just a very interesting issue about how people's brain development comes out in such a way that brains are like fingerprints. Everybody's is very different from one another because of this complicated interaction.
This reminds me of a study that you mentioned in your book where there was a blind man, and he had been blind all of his life. And then they managed to, you know, discover a surgery that was able to restore his sight. And there was going to be this emotional meeting where he first lays eyes on his kids and sort of have this Hollywood perception. It's going to be this beautiful moment. Where he sees the world as you and I do. But that's not what happens.
That's not what happened. There was a photographer there to take a picture of this moment. He actually had vision for the first 4 or 5 years of his life, but then in a chemical explosion lost it, right? So at the age of 40, he got his corneas clear in this surgery. Yeah, and what happened was his eyes were functioning fine, but he wasn't actually seeing. It's just because even though his visual system was working, your brain has to interpret this completely crazy barrage of electrical signals. And so his brain didn't know how to interpret it. It was just seeing, sort of shapes and edges and things, and he couldn't make sense of it. It took him a couple of weeks of going around and touching and kicking and feeling the world to get it, to correlate things with his other senses until he could make sense of it. But it's a good way of illustrating that, you know, reality doesn't come for free. It's a construction of the brain based on interpretation of these electrical signals.
So in that way, he was similar to my child, like just it's brand new, and he's developing those interpretations as he goes along.
That's right. And I'm glad you asked that about your child. What's your son's name?
Ira.
Ira? Mm-hmm. So what's going on is the different parts of the brain develop at different speeds, and the most slowly developing part is the frontal lobes. Mm-hmm. And the frontal lobes are essentially, you know, this is what involves executive control, but more than that, these are like the engine of socialization. This is what takes all the sort of impulse gratification that the rest of your brain wants to do and makes longer-term planning. It's deliberative. It thinks about the future. The interesting thing is time, our notion of living in time, is a cognitive development. Little kids don't get that. They have to learn that. How old is Ira now?
He's 6 months.
Okay. You can, even when he's 3 years old, if you show him a video of himself kicking around a soccer ball, he won't get that that's him in the video. It doesn't make sense to him that it's an existence of his at a different time point. You have to actually learn that. And people get better and better at this sort of long-term decision-making and considering options and so on. So it has been argued that children have less free will than adults, maybe none in some sense, because children don't have sort of a lot of options to choose between and considerations and deliberation about the future. They only have impulse gratification because this part of their brain is just beginning to develop, and your job as a parent is to give him lots and lots of feedback about, no, you're not allowed to do that, and so on, and that's how you socialize him.
I'm going to come back to the free will point.
Okay.
But taking that idea forward, does that mean at 5 it's different than it is at 10, as it is at 20, as it is all the way to 90, that's constantly changing? So our interpretation, our perception, is not a single focused target, that it's always evolving as we age.
It's a great question. The general story is the development of your prefrontal lobes gets essentially completed by the time you're in your early 20s. And so that's sort of the major landmark. And, of course, mm-hmm. car insurance companies know this. And, you know, voting legislation and drinking legislation, this is... And, of course, the Supreme Court has ruled on this in several cases about, can you execute somebody who committed a crime when they were a minor? And essentially the punchline is, you can't, because a kid's brain is different from an adult's brain. They just don't have the same brains. They don't have the same capacity for long-term decision-making. What's going to go up in front of the Supreme Court very soon, by the way, is can you give someone who commits a crime as a child a life sentence with no option of parole? Because that's what a lot of kids get for particularly heinous crimes. But it really doesn't make sense, because the 57-year-old person has almost nothing in common with that 14-year-old. Anyway, that's another story. Your question about whether things change throughout a lifetime, I think the general thing is people do get better as they age at thinking about longer and longer term time scales.
So as they have less and less time, they get better and longer and longer.
Seems to be the case, yeah. I mean, when you teach little kids about, you know, the ancient Greeks or the Romans, it's very hard for them to understand time scales like that. You need to be older to really get that.
I want to come back to this notion of free will, because it's a theme that emerged in your book. And I want to actually know, you're sort of renowned for being a bit of a libertarian on some level. Hmm. Oh, maybe there's disagreement there. But how do you sort of see free will in the context of neuroscience and what we're talking about here?
I tell you, here's the problem that a lot of neuroscientists see with the notion of free will, is that when you look in the brain, every part of the brain is driving other parts and is driven by other parts. What you're looking at is a big network of, you know, wet biological gushy stuff, but everything's driving everything else. And that is machine-like in that way. And so the difficulty is figuring out, where do you slip in free will? I mean, if everything is just causally driving everything else, where does the ghost in the machine go, right? So for this reason and others, many neuroscientists come down on the conclusion that we don't have any free will. It's an illusion. So when I was writing this book, I really wanted to, you know, come down on a clear side one way or the other. And, you know, there's a giant literature on this. But what I concluded is we just don't have the killer experiment that decides this debate. I don't know if we have free will or not. Here's what I did conclude in the book that I think is an important point. We may well have free will, but if we do, it is limited. It is constrained in how much play in the wheel it has. So here's what I mean. because of this complex development with genes and environment, everybody's brain is different. And that means if there's something like free choice, our science might be too young to understand what that means or how that actually fits in the machinery. But anyway, it doesn't have that much room. Let me just back up one step to tell you how I started coming to this as a kid. My father is a forensic psychiatrist, and in Albuquerque, where I grew up, he was involved in all the mass murder cases. And one of them was of this guy, William Wayne Gilbert, who killed 18 people. And my father spent many hours of deposition with him. So someone says to my father at a party, oh, well, he shouldn't get the death penalty because for sure he feels regret about what he's done. And my father said, actually, when you talk to him, when he describes going out to murder someone, he has the same level of excitement as he did as a child on the night before Christmas. That's the level of excitement he feels even now when he thinks about going to murder somebody, right? So the point is this. It is very difficult to put yourself in somebody else's shoes neurally. We all like to think we can. We all like to think we have good theory of mind and we can imagine what it's like to be each other. But especially at the outliers, it might be impossible for us to do that. So here's what I mean. Your brain is sort of over here, and you can use your free choice to make certain decisions. William Wayne Gilbert's brain is over there. He might have free choice, but he has a very different brain than yours. You're not able to look at him and say, well, I wouldn't use my free will to make those decisions because you're not anything like him. And there's probably no amount of free will that you can use to make yourself like him, nor he like you. I mean, one example of this is just whatever your sexual orientation is, try using your free will to switch that. Just make yourself the opposite, right? You'll see that you're kind of constrained. You're biologically wired up in a particular way. So this is what I think about free will. We may well have it. It's hard to know, but it's constrained.
This begs so many questions. But I think it tracks back to something you said earlier, that you sort of intimated that we're at the beginning of a search here around some of these big topics in neuroscience. And I was wondering if you see it that way or if we're on the edge or the precipice of a major discovery in this.
So here's what we know. There are many unsolved mysteries, and you never know where the precipice is. So you might, you know, some guy in a basement in Japan might have just carried a two and solved some problem, and now tomorrow it'll get announced that we've solved something. But as it stands right now, some of the biggest unsolved mysteries in neuroscience are very basic things, like how are memories stored and retrieved? What is consciousness? What is intelligence? Why do brains sleep and dream? I mean, these are all things we're working on. There are whole laboratories. I mean, my lab's involved in all these questions. Other labs all over the world are working on this. But, you know, we don't have the answers to these yet, these very basic things. So I think sometimes in a young field like this, it's useful to shine the spotlight on the things that we don't know. And, in fact, the whole last chapter of the book, I talk about what neuroscience can and cannot say at this moment in history, given we've got a ton of terrific data that really steers us in a particular direction. And yet, we have to be careful not to extrapolate too much and make conclusions. Just as one example, most neuroscientists are materialists, meaning, it's all pieces and parts in the brain. And somehow when you put those pieces and parts together in the right configuration, you get consciousness out of it. That may well be right. That's likely to be right. But we don't know that for certain. And the example I use in the book, and please don't cite me on this because I'm not saying this is true. I'm just saying it is consistent with the hypothesis. The example we use in the book is if you were a bushman in the Kalahari Desert and you found a radio in the sand and you realized that, you know, when you dial the knobs around, there are voices magically coming out of this box. So you open up the back of it and you see these wires and you notice that when you pull out certain wires, the voices get garbled, or other wires, the voices stop. So you wouldn't have any concept of electromagnetic radiation in the form of radio waves. That has not even, you've never thought of physics like that. You don't know about distant cities with radio towers. You would have to become a radio materialist. And you would say, okay, well, something about the configuration of these wires gives you voices. And when the wires change, the voices change. Just like when the brain changes, we change. I'm not saying this is true, some radio theory of the brain, but I'm just saying it's equally as consistent with the data we have. So like any scientific field, we just need a little bit of intellectual humility instead of pretending like we know the final answers here.
We're going to start taking your questions in the next couple minutes. So if anyone is interested in asking a question, there are two microphones, so if you can line up behind them. And I'm going to come back to the big punchline then, is are those questions within our reach? Are they answerable? I mean, there's you said, like, there's this huge question ahead of us. What is consciousness? Are we ever going to be able to basically pull cells together, pull neurons together, and keep piling them and piling them together, and suddenly get a sentient being?
That's a great question, and that's sort of the big question on the plate right now. Is it just a matter of getting enough things together? If so, then you might ask whether the city of San Francisco is conscious, because it has, you know, trains and electrical signals and cell phone conversations and handshakes. It's a big system that's operating. It's a big network. Hard to know, because San Francisco doesn't have sort of ears and a mouth with which we can ask it that.
Oh, that's not true. You haven't met some of our political figures.
But so the question is, if you just get enough pieces and parts together, is that sufficient? One thing that my friend and colleague Kevin Kelly and I are doing is starting something called the Search for Internet Intelligence, where we're asking the question, now that we've got this new organism whose nervous system blankets the planet, the Internet, with so many nodes in it, how would you know if it started having its own sort of intelligence? I'm not talking about a Skynet scenario. I'm just talking about as any sort of creature. How would you know if it started feeling something? Now, you might say, oh, that's a wacky question, but it's actually exactly the same question we're asking of the brain. It's a lot of pieces and parts connected in a very complex manner. How do you study that? How do you replicate it? And you know, the answer, unfortunately, in the end is, if we can replicate the brain, all the pieces and parts, let's say you replicate it out of beer cans and tennis balls, the perfect replica of your brain, the best we can do is ask it and say, hey, are you conscious in there? Yeah. Are you warm or cold? Yeah, I'm a little warm. You know, we can just ask it lots of questions, and it essentially has to pass the Turing test, where it convinces us that it's having internal, private, subjective experience.
I want to know how you knew my brain was constructed out of empty beer cans.
I didn't assume they were empty, but thanks for filling them. Yeah.
My final sort of big question around this is really sort of emotional. Like, how do you feel about this burgeoning area? Because there doesn't seem like there's a lot of application that's going to come out of this tomorrow. But it's a study of something that is the greatest unknown and the greatest mystery in all of the world.
Actually, it's a terrific question, but I do think there's application that's coming out right away. In fact, I devote a big chunk of the book to talking about what the social policy implications are. I won't go into it now, except to say that I think what we're learning in neuroscience will change the way we run the legal system. And I have an article in this month's Atlantic magazine that's all about how neuroscience will change the legal system. So I think there are very direct applications, and we're building technologies in my lab to help people, for example, overcome addiction. Instead of stuffing drug addicts in jail, we can actually help them using real-time feedback and neuroimaging. So I think there are applications. But in answer to your question, it's like a numinous experience to me, this whole thing, because it's exactly what happened with studying outer space and the cosmos. You know, a mere 500 years ago, people thought, actually 400 years ago, people thought, okay, well, we're at the center, there's some spheres around us, bang. Galileo discovered the moons of Jupiter, things fell apart, we realized we're actually at the distant edge of a galaxy. There are as many, you know, galaxies outside of our own as there are stars within our galaxy. That's opened us up to something much more subtle and magnificent than we ever thought. That's exactly what's happening when we sail into the inner cosmos. What we're discovering is that this is this alien computational fabric. We've never seen anything like it. It is us. It's the most wondrous thing we've ever discovered in the universe. And it is us. And so to me, it just doesn't get any better than that.
I think I understand why you're a neuroscientist. As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum. Connect your intellect. And tonight we're hosting The Brains Behind the Mind with David Eagleman, neuroscientist at Baylor School of Medicine and author of Incognito. I think we're going to toss it to the audience, and we're going to start with this woman here.
Hi. This question is about unconsciousness, subconsciousness. I have found occasionally I will be doing something, and I suspect something subconscious is triggered, and I will become unconscious, and I will need to go out for a few minutes and come back. And then I'm in much better shape. Could be driving, I pull off the road, or it could be talking, having a conversation, or working on something. And I was curious if you've had experiences about this and what you might have found.
Thank you for that question. I actually should clarify something. I use the word subconscious and unconscious as the same thing. That's been the linguistic trend in neurosciences to use those as being synonymous terms. But do I understand the question to mean that sometimes you just have to go to sleep or pull off or something like that?
Right. And it seems to be something in the environment is triggering something from before. I've recently been tutoring learning spelling, and it's strenuous and easy, not easy for me. And I've noticed that I will conk out in the middle of doing it, sleep for a few moments, and come back, and I'll be fine. But
Well, let me say this. I can talk to you privately about this afterwards, because there might be some mild narcolepsy there, but the important point is what is now has become clear is that the point of sleep has to do with learning and memory. It has to do with consolidating information. Sleep inspires insight. It allows you to rehearse things and come up with stuff. And it's often very helpful if you've got a lot of sensory stimulation. It's hard to rehearse things and have insight. And so sleep is all about that. So it may be that your brain is enjoying that
calculating
process.
And stuff.
Yeah. We're going to go to the next question over here.
Thanks. Hi. So there's this whole movement called mindfulness or being present. And I was wondering if that's kind of like the conscious mind aware of the subconscious or the conscious aware of the conscious. But it seems to be a real new age metaphysical movement. And you hear it in yoga class. And
I mean, it's certainly an old movement. It has its roots in meditation going back thousands of years. And, one of my colleagues in Germany, Thomas Metzinger, has been proposing that mindfulness training and meditation should be mandatory for all elementary school students. He's trying to get this into the education there. I think it's a terrific idea because we're at a point now more than ever where every advertiser is trying to get everybody's attention, blings and bings, and trying to get you all about, monitoring the outside world and monitoring their product. And part of the brain toolkit should be this capacity to turn inward and not be just, simply responding to external environment. And it has very nice effects on stress levels and glucocorticoids and so on.
Do you personally meditate?
Unfortunately, I don't have time, which is really the whole... Yeah. But I would, yes.
You don't have the perception of enough time in your life. We're going to take the next question over here.
Okay. It's hopefully just quick, but with the discussion of free will, I actually was just curious how you would define, what definition you would give of free will, because I think people might have many varied definitions.
Thanks for the clarification. Yeah, essentially it's the uncaused causer is how people think about this. So, we look in the brain and everything is driving other things in sort of a causal network, and free will would be the kind of thing where we say, oh, look, it wasn't predetermined by the machinery of this causing that, but instead there was something metaphysical. And of course, metaphysical can mean, something spooky and religious or whatever, or it could mean something that we just don't understand in the science of 2011. Either way. But what we mean is it's not just the Newtonian physics of the neurobiology that we get right now. It has to mean something else that's not caused as just the last step of something.
We're going to take a next question over here.
Okay, I work with hypnotherapy and guided imagery. And many times we'll be working with the client who has a perception of their life being a certain way, like I've always been too fat, I've always been too anxious, whatever. So we talk to them about what they say to themselves, what their negative thoughts are. And I was wondering what your thoughts are about manipulating your mind and your thoughts to be more positive, and in that way, taking control of your thoughts rather than be a victim of your thoughts.
I think it's a good process, and it's essentially like the CEO setting the long-term goals of the company, saying, I want to be good at tennis, I want to be the kind of person who does X, Y, Z. I think it's exactly taking this little, the little powers that the CEO has to say, all right, here's what we want for the company. I don't know how we're going to make it work, but I'm going to train up the unconscious robotic machinery to make it happen.
Do you see it as a potential future? There's this idea of personalized medicine emerging in biomedical fields. Could there be something along the lines of personalized brain treatments to increase your plasticity or increase a number of different factors? Is that something that could be on the horizon?
Yes, and it already is in the sense that with rehabilitative programs for whatever it is, psychological problems or even rehabilitation from stroke, you know, these are very personalized. You have to work exactly with the patient, find out what their motivations are, because it turns out there are particular neurotransmitters in the brain that are required for plasticity, for the brain to change, and those are related to motivation. You need to get the person involved in wanting to make that change, and so that's a real personalized thing. What we're doing right now, just quickly, is using real-time feedback in neuroimaging, where we measure the particulars of your brain and exactly the networks in your brain involved in craving, and we allow you to address those.
Well, we'll take the next question over here.
Oh, hi. I was just curious how you consciously came up with the name of your book. Are we all hiding behind our conscience?
How did I come up with the name of my book? So the idea is that most of the operations of the brain are running incognito. They're running under the hood. You don't have access to or acquaintance with those operations. And I also loved the fact that it was an anagram of cognition. That was part of it. But, the main thing was that most of the operations are hidden or incognito. Thank you for that.
Hi, we've talked a fair bit about CEOs. I run a startup. I'm an architect. My question is about short-term memory and what is the capacity of a brain to, say, hold a certain set of errands? For example, I'd say call Mr. Smith, take care of insurance, or you have, you know, 20 errands in your head which you want to do tomorrow or next week or in the month. So how does the brain work, or can you train the brain to hold a larger set of ideas and thoughts, errands, or tasks that it needs to do? So I'm curious about that.
I mentioned before one of the unsolved mysteries is what is intelligence, and some people feel that intelligence has to do with your short-term working memory capacity, how many things you can hold in your head at once. That's almost certainly not the whole story of intelligence. It's probably just a piece of it, but anyway, that's one thing people are exploring. When you come to the table, different people have different capacities for that. If you want to become a synesthete, that will help you because you can tag memories with different things. But I'll just say briefly that even the ancient Greeks came up with devices, mnemonic ways of storing lots of things in their memory, and the most used way is to put things in different spatial locations. So you imagine walking through your house, and at each point in your house, which is a location you know very well, you put that thing. Okay, remember to go grocery shopping, so you're going to imagine grocery bags here. Remember to write back to so-and-so, you put so-and-so here and so on. And then all you need to do is think about walking through all these different spatial locations, and you've tagged each idea with spatial locations, the best way to remember a long list of things. Thanks for that.
So I got stuck on this thing that you said when you were talking about when we make ideas, and you said that there's all this stuff going on in the background, and it's not you that makes the idea. So I was wondering why you used you, and if you were just meaning conscious you or what.
Thank you for that question. I was being flippant because I do exactly mean the conscious you,
okay.
Which is really how we think about ourselves, though. I mean, you know, when I'm lifting the glass of water, I'm just thinking about, was the conscious me an idiot and spilled it or not? I'm not thinking about the, you know, 70 million neurons that had a fire and an intricate pattern to make it happen. And so when you think about you, yeah, I'm really talking about that little bit of your brain. The analogy that I use in the book is that your conscious you is like a stowaway on a transatlantic steamship that's taking credit for the whole journey without acknowledging the massive engineering that's underfoot. Thanks for that question.
Wow, you're referring to our conscious mind as a stowaway.
Yes.
That might trip me up a little later tonight. We have time for two more questions.
In your book, you talk about the two segments of your brain changed the way they communicate about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. That seemed awfully recent, and it had something to do with how consciousness evolved.
I was only spending one paragraph citing the theory of a colleague of mine named Julian Jaynes, who has this theory that consciousness emerged when the two hemispheres of the brain started talking to each other in more detail. It's such a crazy hypothesis that, as Richard Dawkins put it, it's either genius or it's rubbish, but nobody knows which. So, but anyway, I mentioned it in the book in one paragraph to say that it is an idea on the table that consciousness is actually a very recent phenomenon.
We're going to take one last question.
So what I've noticed is that earlier you were talking about how the subconscious mind tends to focus on lots of different stuff at once and try to analyze everything. Well, I personally noticed that I tend to do that a lot, like myself. Like just sitting in this room while talking to you and listening to you, I'll also be paying attention to like 20 other people doing stuff at once. And I'm wondering if that's sort of like maybe someone who has a bit more connection with that certain area of your subconscious mind that notices stuff.
It's an interesting question. It may not have to do with having a deeper connection with the subconscious. Instead, what it might have to do with is you have frontal lobe circuits that are all about locking on to something and staying focused. And, you know, it takes training with children and so on to train them to stay focused on something. And what happens is, I think now in this era, more than ever, with all of the, you know, pulls on our entertainment time and fast movie cuts and million things you can do, it's hard. I think this is going to be the currency for the next generation, is who can really stay focused on one thing for a long time and go deeply into it. I don't necessarily think it's a deeper connection with the subconscious. I think it's just a matter of, you know, not locking on to one thing, but going to the next and the next. This is the big thing that educators and policymakers are very interested in right now, is what does this mean for the digital generation? Will they be able to concentrate on something for a long time? Anyway, thanks for that question.
Do you ever see yourself leaving science? I mean, you're a successful writer. No, this is home?
No, yeah, this is home. And the reason I write is because I'm passionate about the stuff that I study in the lab. And so if I left the lab, I think I would feel like I had empty beer cans and tennis balls.
One last question for you, something we ask all of our speakers at Inforum. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? But you can only have one. You've had a few ideas that are probably going to change the world, but just one.
I would have a day where we would celebrate uncertainty, and we would celebrate the vastness of our ignorance, and everybody would quit pretending that they know what's going on religiously or metaphysically or things like that. That's my idea.
I wouldn't even know where to begin with something like that. With that, let's give a big round of applause to David Eagleman.
Thank you, guys.
Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum is closed.